The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Something about Sunday morning, I feel like I should be like inspiring preacher, you know. But I more come out of the school of my vibes more in the depressed rabbi kind of. Sort of do what I can. So what's the function of a Dharma talk? Many functions, and one we could say is just to point a way out of the forest of suffering. That suffering is, by its nature, is it kind of regresses us, it disorients us, bewilders us. Like the state of mind amidst suffering is often kind of bewildered. And we forget so much. Suffering is a kind of forgetting. And so the Buddha says, teach step by step to actually even just begin to name suffering as suffering, and to begin to see the patterns, to see, oh, I am in the forest right now. What can be remembered? What wisdom, what love can be remembered? Dharma talks are a kind of invitation for people to look more carefully at experience, to actually inspire investigation. So the Buddha said, like, when we're suffering, we can blame ourselves, blame others, despair, or investigate. Yeah? D. The answer is D. Yeah? Right? And a lot of the function of Dharma talks are actually to get us interested in experience, right? Because also in suffering, in the storms of suffering, there's a way in which there's a certain kind of disinterest in what's actually happening moment by moment. And we're so mesmerized in the kind of, by the pain or the confusion of the moment, that there isn't this kind of like hunger to look. And a lot of the Dharma is just about finding ways to re-engage and get interested. What is actually happening? Dharma talks are sometimes meant to unsettle us. Yeah. I'm realizing it's easy as a teacher, without really knowing that one's doing it, it's easy to kind of collude in creating Dharma talks that make us feel good. Yeah? And in one way, that's totally appropriate. It's like they should mostly feel good. That we need, like, refuge. We need shelter from the storm. We need ways of reconnecting with our heart. We need a sense of solidarity together. We need to actually feel all of this. And without even knowing it, sometimes it's like I can feel like I'm being coached into giving Dharma talks that lead people to feel good. Right? And so somehow I wind up giving more talks on metta than renunciation. Yeah? But renunciation is just as beautiful. Yeah? so sometimes talks unsettle us and are the kind of there's a certain willingness to like feel the pain of growth, yeah, like growth pains, right? We think about Dharma talks like they're information is disseminated, but they're really also powerfully like a transmission, meaning that the teacher invites us into her mind, and we can kind of rest there, like rest in the kind of spaciousness or the field of her own mind. And so it's not exactly a kind of hypnotic induction or something, but it's not totally different, yeah? In the sense that, that something is happens when we're kind of invited into something, and it's less about kind of like verbal information being shared, you know. Like sometimes people say to me, like, you know, Matthew, I don't really know what you're talking about, and I don't really care, which is not maybe the highest compliment, but it's like, I don't really care, but something happens, you know, yeah? And that something is usually the sense of like, okay, we're actually dwelling in the Dharma together, yeah? And some teachers, I feel this with very, very strongly. It's like, I feel like I'm like sitting in the lap of their mind, yeah? And it just like, oh, we can rest there. Early in practice, I remember kind of listening to, it was cassette tapes with of Jack Kornfield, and I just, yeah, there was even with the kind of through the medium of you know, like recorded audio, it was, I could still sense his heart, mind, and it was sort of awakening like long forgotten dormant parts of my own heart, and actually just to have a sense of tasting goodness, tasting the Dharma before I even really knew what that was, but I knew something was being evoked, something was being remembered, and that led me onwards, yeah. Maybe the most important is really just to remind us of goodness, to gladden the mind, and to inspire some persistence to keep going. It's so much of Dharma talk's function just to normalize the peaks and valleys of a Dharma life and to encourage persistence. And so this morning I thought to talk a bit about this sort of, hopefully a talk that falls in this last category of like how goodness accrues on this path. And to talk more about some of the kind of outcomes of practice rather than to do more of the kind of step-by-step getting into the trenches of dukkha, of suffering, right? Which is my native ground, you know, like, and I have to sort of resist talking about it. But it's talking about dukkha is a lot different. Knowing dukkha is a lot different than experiencing it. And for me, when I started out practice, it was like so vital to actually hear that we were talking in very honest ways about the moment-to-moment experience of being human, which even if our life is going really well, even if we find ourselves amidst great fortune, privilege, it's intense being human, yeah? And so, Sayadaw Tejaniya says, the noble truth of dukkha, suffering, unsatisfactoriness. The noble truth of dukkha is discerned by the wise and is totally opposite to the kind of dukkha one feels. The understanding of the truth of dukkha is wisdom. The mind feels strength, energy, freedom, detachment with this understanding. Whereas the experience of dukkha is exhausting, the true realization of dukkha is free from clinging. And so that's, in a sense, the backdrop of this, but I do want to talk about, like, okay, how does goodness accumulate? The Buddha was much more explicit about the suffering that gets released than what freedom looks like. And so that just that is kind of interesting, that it's sort of left a little vague. What does a free life look like? What does the awakened heart look like? And there's much less specification around that than what is released. And my experience in knowing practitioners and teachers is that freedom, the burgeoning freedom in someone's heart, looks very idiosyncratic. It's not like there's one fingerprint of a freed heart. It's filtered through one's own personality and quirks and foibles, and it's very idiosyncratic. And it's almost like we become more idiosyncratic the deeper we go into the path. And the kind of the sort of tidy maps that we have that map out the transformations of the heart mind on the path and have various kind of signposts and archetypes of what this looks like, it's messier than that, as far as I can tell. And the idea that there are experiences that are both like necessary and sufficient to wake us up, have to have them, and they themselves are sufficient. You don't need anything else. I don't know how many experiences there are like that. This would be a debate with more traditional formulations of the Dharma, but I don't know how many experiences are like truly necessary and totally sufficient to wake us up. Sometimes things happen dramatically, and it feels like we can point to something. We can point to an experience and say, absolutely, a before and after. Yeah. This is a famous description from Bill Wilson when he had an experience leading to his sobriety, and from obviously a different tradition, but resonances with our own. And so it says, suddenly the room lit up with a great white light. I was caught up in an ecstasy which there are no words to describe. It seemed to me in the mind's eye that I was on a mountain and that a wind, not of air but of spirit, was blowing. And then it burst upon me that I was a free man. Slowly the ecstasy subsided. I lay on the bed, but now, for a time, I was in another world, a new world of consciousness. All about me and through me was there was a wonderful feeling of presence, and I thought to myself, so this is the God of the preachers. A great peace stole over me, and I thought, no matter how wrong things seem to be, they are all right. The kind of sudden dramatic changes that we feel introduced or safe in a new way, those are celebrated, but much of the way the path actually develops is in this very gradual way. Like Suzuki Roshi famously said, like getting wet by walking through mist for a long while. And then said, when you get wet walking through mist, it's very hot, hard to dry off, yeah? And so often we're trying to track our progress, and it can almost be like after each mindful breath, we sort of like look around to see if we're wiser, you know, like, or more concentrated or more free or something, right? And like the image that I had recently was like, it's like going to the gym and like doing like one repetition, and then we like look at our bicep and like, how's it going? You know, like, and then we get into like this whole like thing, you know, I mean, literally the equivalence of like talking with our bicep, even though it's enough just to do the repetition, yeah? And because we can look at the kind of surface layer of our mind and judge, well, how concentrated am I? How much chatter is there? How peaceful? How pleasant? Like all these things are kind of these markers that are not really reliable indicators, but because we can look to them compulsively, we get fixated, yeah? And so we're like sampling data all the time to see how it's going, right? And a lot of it, we just are learning to actually trust the logic of the practice, the logic of the Dharma, to just breathe, to just do the repetition. Yeah. So for me, just having a path feels like goodness. You know, like as a kid, I can remember like sort of testing out various ways that my life could unfold, you know, just imagining them, right? And that was kind of painful because I really couldn't envision the kind of happiness and peace that some part of me was really longing for. And so even amidst good fortune and safety, I just sort of simulated various futures and had the sense of like that can't do it for me. That will leave me feeling incomplete. And not that those are bad lives, but it's like I did have some, there was some intuitive connection with a kind of longing for something, for a path, actually. And Gil has said something like, you know, he's just like, he's so happy to actually have a path of practice. He doesn't even care so much how he's doing, yeah? And it's beautiful, yeah? So in a way, we kind of fall in love with the Dharma. And just to be in love with something that feels good, that feels like a kind of companionship in a way. So there's no, as the practice unfolds, there's no more kind of questioning about practice, about doubt in oneself, that kind of sense of like the ambivalence that riddles the mind sometimes for years or decades. It just like that collapses. And that sense of like, can I do this? Is this right? Is this like, do I have the capacities? Like that actually really just dissolves. And the kind of relief from being out of the grips of that kind of obsessive, ambivalent rumination is very relieving. It's very relieving. And so we're left just walking a path that may look a million different ways, you know, a thousand ways to kiss the ground, as Rumi says, right? But it's like, oh yeah, it's life just gets a lot simpler. In a sense, there is maybe we say an end to seeking. That kind of nagging sense of like, okay, I'm gonna be someone, become someone, get something. I'm going to like add the Dharma to my life. That kind of, that falls away sometimes very dramatically, and the kind of relief of like not seeking something outside of oneself and not perceiving oneself as this kind of deficient creature that's still on the hunt for goodness. Like that is, it's very relieving. It's very relieving to just give that up. Yeah. Part of not understanding ourselves so well is not really knowing what we want. And so it's very common that we find ourselves in one way or another living someone else's vision of a good life. That we don't realize all the ways in which we've accumulated ideas about what a good life is. We don't know where exactly we've inherited all of it from. And often we haven't even evaluated, like, does this actually feel like a viable philosophy of happiness for me? And so part of Dharma practice is actually becoming more honest, realistic about what we want. It's about knowing what we want, which doesn't sound very Buddhist, yeah? Right? Because we're used to hearing about non-clinging, right? But the teacher I was just teaching with last week, Philip Moffat, had been with Ajahn Sumedho on a retreat the previous week. And Ajahn Sumedho is kind of one of the senior monastics in the Thai forest lineage. And Ajahn Sumedho is like, no. Desire fills the room. Desire is not the problem. It is clinging to desire, right? It is essentially acting out our preferences in a compulsive way. That is the engine of suffering. And so as we actually start to know more and more about ourselves, we start to know what we want. There is simultaneously like the relinquishment of clinging, but we actually know what we want more deeply. And this is helpful, right? In I remember in college reading reading Don DeLillo's White Noise, and one of the descriptions of like the end of summer converging in a college town was, you know, the kind of garage sales he described as driveways arrayed with failed possessions. Yeah. Somehow that's stuck in my mind for 20 years, you know, but it's like, yeah, failed possessions, right? What do we actually want? That's maybe more innocuous, what something we buy, right? But what about like actually attuning to the deeper set of goals that we long for? So there's a body of research on affective forecasting, imagining what the emotional impacts of events in the future. And we're not too good at this. Yeah. So this is these are two researchers who are very involved in this. So Wilson and Dan Gilbert says affective forecasts are important because people base many decisions on them. Decisions about who to marry, what career to pursue, whether to donate money are based at least in part on predictions about how these decisions will make one feel. To the extent that people's predictions about what will make them happy are flawed, people fail at maximizing their happiness. Finding ways to increase the accuracy of affective forecasts is a worthy enterprise, though not, we suspect, a particularly easy one. Over the course of a Dharma life, we get better, I think, at predicting what will actually make us happy. And we become more realistic in not buying into the ways that goals often overpromise. Yeah, right. It's like one psychoanalyst said: "There's nothing like getting what you want to realize you don't fully know yourself." Yeah, right. Like you get it. And there's still something incomplete in the heart, right? And to be actually realistic about what goals, accomplishments, attainment of various kinds, like what that gets you and what that doesn't, actually really helps us dial in and calibrate how we want to relate to this, yeah? How much energy is worth it, and actually being realistic about what accomplishments do and don't do for the heart. Our intuition gets better over the course of practice, like that just very subtle yes, no approach, avoid. Like we start to listen in more deeply to something, you know? And it cuts through the kind of some of the analytic approach, which is useful, is vitally important in some ways, but we actually, like a lot of times, what we really need to hear is that very subtle yes, no. Because in that contains a lot of data about what we need and what we want, about what we can handle, about the limits of our equanimity. Yeah. And so we actually learn to tune into that. And so much of a Dharma life feels like there's analytic, it's like a pairing the analytic thinking with the kind of that other channel of data that we become open to, and to learn when that's most trustworthy, when it's not. This helps us live. As the Dharma transforms our heart, people, I think, come to treat us differently. And that's not to minimize the kind of realities of the ways that racism or sexism distorts the treatment of people. But I think over time, as our heart blossoms, we come to evoke less defensiveness in others. We come to evoke less fear in others. They actually can sense the refuge of your own heart in some way. And that changes how the field of the relations, yeah? We feel more and more transparent. So Rilke says, I want to unfold. I don't want to be folded anywhere, because where I am folded, there I am a lie. And so as we go about this process of kind of like gathering up the shards of our own past, of starting to kind of metabolize our own history, there's less and less to be ashamed about. Yeah. We talk all about being present, but the present is composed of the past. The present, in a sense, is the leading edge of everything that's come before. And in one sense, to be present, to be here now, is actually to make very deep peace with the past. To make deep peace with the past in the sense that all of the momentum of our habits and energy and ideas and memories and loves and heartbreaks and all of it, like, protrudes into the present, yeah? And moment by moment, we are blessing the past, blessing memory, blessing the energy, the karmic momentum of our life. We're blessing all of that with wisdom and love, yeah? And as that happens, there's a way in which we become less intimidated by our past, less intimidated by our inner life, by our feelings. And we become, like, just naturally move towards more and more transparency. There's less and less to hide. Less and less to hide. And the feeling of, like, oh, I can't be found out. There's a bliss in that. Yeah. That dissolves so much of the anxiety that is around curating one's self-presentation. Yeah. There's a confidence in the heart, a kind of trust in equanimity, and the sense of, like, oh, okay, I can't be run over by experience in the same way. It's like, yeah, bad things can happen, loss is inevitable, and there is a kind of confidence in the strength of the heart to weather the intensities of a life. And that sense that the winds of feeling, the winds of pain will blow, but they will not blow something over in our own heart, that is like inspires a certain kind of ease and confidence in our living. There's so much less attention pooled up in ourselves. Like, yeah, I feel like one of the great gifts of Dharma practice has been that I think about myself and like the project of my life dramatically less. Yeah. Like I actually, if Ajahn Sumedho said, like, you know, whatever, 50 years more, 60 years of monastic practice, like every time I think of myself, I get depressed. Yeah. Yeah. In that sense of just like, oh yeah, me and my. And this, some of this is developed, you know, it's like you have to be sensitive to the developmental phase. Sometimes it's totally healthy, important, you know, but that sense of like me and my life and where it's going and my, you know, like the path of my happiness and my livelihood and all of that and who I'm becoming and the kind of ladder, you know, like, oh, let me put all of that down, right? And that sense of just like, okay, like that, just being freed from the fantasy of like, I'm going to grow into the person I'm supposed to be. Yeah. Or I need to like, you know, I'm this big kind of like self-improvement project and I'm just going to keep working for a few decades and then I can rest, right? It's just like, we just don't think of ourselves in that same way. Our behavior begins to align more fully with our deepest values. Yeah. And to be aligned, to be like really aligned, the Buddha described it as bliss. To actually not think about one's life and get kind of mired in guilt and the kind of story of self, and you know, it's not that. It's more a sense of appreciating, like coming to peace with whatever harm we have done, and knowing that a part of our heart really wishes not to do that again. And some of this growth is very, it feels blissful, but then there's this other side, which is like the story we tell about ethical goodness is not final, meaning that we are called into a kind of evolution as ethical creatures. And so we actually keep refining our ethical intuitions, knowing the fragility of life, yeah? We keep refining, like, okay, what does goodness entail? What does goodness entail? And this means that we actually have to tolerate a sense of moral incoherence sometimes. That kind of haunting, unsettling effect of feeling like, oh, I don't know if I can justify my life. Yeah. And that is something we glance over or just like causes shame or we just avoid entirely. But actually part of the strength, the fruit of Dharma practice is like it provides us the courage to feel into the zones of moral incoherence, where we're actually out of, where if we trace out the implications of our deepest values, we're out of alignment. And for me, this continues. This just is a kind of unending question of actually how do I refine my behavior? What does goodness ask for me? Maybe more than I think, maybe more than I'm ready to give right now. But I actually try to hold that sense of the undefendable quality of the ways in which I privilege my own pleasure over the well-being of others in distant continents, yeah? And I just try to actually stay in relationship to that. But there's the Dharma practice actually gives us some of the courage to stay with that, to evolve ethically. What do we owe to others, to the least fortunate, to future generations, to non-human animals? What do we owe? What do we owe? And to actually just stay with that in a way that doesn't deflate us, but enlivens us. Yeah? And then, at some point it's like, We've sort of touched into goodness. We've explored enough of the chambers of the mind that life actually feels complete. You know? And in some sense, I feel like we'll never be ready to die, even if life were 1,000 years, we might still want to hold on. But marinating in goodness, knowing these all the capacities of the heart mind, that actually, I think, helps us lead to a sense of completion. Life actually feels complete. And then whatever time is left is gravy. Gives us courage to live and to die. Just sit for a moment. Thank you. So just offer that for your consideration. Yeah, please, as we often say, pick up what is useful and leave the rest behind. Yeah. And I'll hang around for a bit if you have questions or want to chat. So thank you. Thanks for having me.